There we go. Okay. In Parshat Shlach is chock full of great stuff to talk about. What kind of mission was it? How do we compare and weave together, if possible, the mission as described here with the way it's described at the beginning of Sefer Dvarim? Was it the people's idea? Was it God's idea? Are they spies? Are they scouts? All of that, which is a great part of the narrative. Kalev's role, Yehoshua's role, a lot of good stuff. The last parak, which we dealt with a couple of years ago, is part of this literary style of Sefer Bamidbar, which is unique, in which you have narratives and law that kind of riff off of each other. And so, for instance, Korach, we read about the rebellion against Aaron being the Kohen, and then there's a series of laws of the gifts to the Kohuna. Chukat, we hear about Tumat Mate, and then we hear about both Miriam and Aaron dying. So there's this symbiotic relationship between the law and the narrative, and it really starts here, because in Parshat Shlach, you have the whole narrative, it may start earlier in Balotcha, but you have the whole narrative of the quote-unquote Meraglim, essentially a rejection of the land, and the final chapter has a series of laws that take place either in the land or a reflection to some extent of the story of the Meraglim. So it starts off with Nisachim, and Rashi on the spot points out, here God has given them good news that they will come to the land, because when you come to the land and you offer Korban, you have to bring, and essentially you're bringing from the three major produce highlights of the land, which are Dagon, Tirosh, V'Yitzhar, grain and oil and wine. So the grain and oil are mixed together in a mincha, and the wine and menachot. And then challah, which comes, of course, from the wheat of the land. And it seems to be focused around saying, you're going to come to the land, and here's what you're going to do to sanctify the land, and sort of as a response to the story. Then, of course, the end, which is Parshat Tzitzit, is very clearly, in a sense, a response to the story of the Meraglim, because the Meraglim were sent latur et haaretz, and this is lo taturu. And in the punishment against the nation for what they did, it says, "Uvnechem yisu et znutechem," your children will bear your lack of fidelity, your lack of loyalty, your znut. And here it's asheratem zonim acharehem in Parshat Tzitzit. So it's clearly a connection, at least with the way the Parshat Tzitzit is worded, with its location here. But right before the thing of Tzitzit, the Parshat Tzitzit, you have, is the penultimate piece in the Parsha, is the story of the Mekoshesh. Now, the Mekoshesh is a problem, and I'll scope out the problem right now, and the Gemara deals with that, which is that there is a standard in law, which is that a person can never get any sort of a corporal or capital punishment unless they've been given exact, clear, heard warning, which includes the exact consequences. When I say heard, it means they have to confirm that they heard it, and they nonetheless are going to go ahead. So if somebody's about to mechalal Shabbat, you have to say, don't do that. It's chilul Shabbat. You're doing the malacha of Nzorea. And if you do it, you're chayav skila. And the guy says, I don't care. I know all that stuff. I don't care. And goes ahead and plants, which makes the guy one of the biggest idiots in the world, but he's also chayav mita. But there's numerous sugyot, mainly in Sanhedrin, that deal with that issue of what we call hatra'ah, which becomes a problem here. And so I'd like to take a look, but that's not my main focus here. I want to look at the fact that we have no idea who the Mekoshesh is. And I want to kind of explore and survey the issue of anonymity in Tanakh. So the story goes as follows. Vayuvnei Yisrael Bamidbar, and this story comes out of nowhere, by the way, and its location within this parak is itself a mystery, and we dealt with that a couple of years ago. Vayuvnei Yisrael Bamidbar, Vayimtzu Ish Mekoshesh Etzim B'Yom HaShabbat. The guy's collecting wood. What exact malacha was involved with? There's a three-way machloket. We'll see one of the opinions soon, but he was violating Shabbat in some way. So the people who found him gathering the wood brought him El Moshe V'El Aharon V'El Kol Ha'ida, which is a constant Sefer Bamidbar trope of this mass gathering. You know, when the scouts came back at the beginning of the Parsha, they gathered Moshe and Aharon Kol Ha'ida. When Datan and Aviram challenged Moshe, Moshe V'El Kol Ha'ida. or Korach, Moshe Aaron Kol Aida. And when Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven come forward, they speak to Moshe Aaron and Kol Aida. Moshe and Elazar, actually, Kol Aida. Right, so there's this Kol Aida thing going on, and they bring this guy to in this public forum. They put him in some sort of guardhouse, because it wasn't yet explicated what should happen to him. Now, if you think about it, that line should be the end of the story. And the guy should just stay in limbo forever. Because since we at no point had gotten a directive as to what punishment he gets, therefore, he could not have been properly warned. If he wasn't properly warned, nothing could happen to him. So, although keeping in Mishmar indefinitely is fine because you're not hurting him physically, but doing anything to him would be a problem. Nonetheless, Vayomar Adonai Moshe, Mot Yumataish, the guy has to die. Ragomotov Amanim Kol Aida Michutz Tamachane, has to be stoned outside of the Machane. And what happens? Vayotzioto Kol Aida Michutz Tamachane, Vayomotov Amanim, Vayamot, Kasher Tzio Adonai Moshe. And so that's exactly what they did. Now, again, the problem here is of Hatra. And the Gemara at Sanhedrin deals with this problem of how the Hatra'ah here works. What I think is a suggestion that may work here is that you notice that it mentions Vayuvan Yisrael Bamidbar Vayimtzu Ish Mikoshesh Etzim Yom HaShabbat. This may be the second half of a story that we heard a long time ago. If you recall, when we hear the story of the man, which is before Matan Torah, before the whole legal system was given, we heard about the two commands that were violated. One command that was violated was when Hashem said, don't leave any over till the morning. And some people did, and it went sour and bad. The other was kind of the inverse of that, which was that on Friday, double would fall, and you do keep it over for the next day. And nobody should go out to collect. And some people went out to collect, and Hashem got very angry. And the anger was directed at Bnei Yisrael. Why are they rejecting? I've given you this beautiful thing called Shabbat. Keep the Shabbat. And Moshe comes out and says, today you won't find it. Today is the day of Shabbat, etc. And Shabbat is introduced and it's beautiful. What we do not hear about in that story is what happened to the guys who went out to collect. We don't hear about any consequences to them. Now you could say that there were no consequences except for being yelled at, which is pretty big. But the simple reason is because Shabbat had not been formally given. Except that Shabbat had been given because on Friday, when the double portion came down and the Nesim came to Moshe and they asked him what it's about. So he said, oh, this is Shabbat. Ayom lo timtzu basadeh. And it seems from Pshat that it was the next week that they went out to collect. All right, we did the cheshbon once of how that came out in the 29th of Iyar or so. And that seems to be, so they did seem to be commanded. So it's possible that when by Yitzu Anashim Lekod, Anashim doesn't have to be people. It could be one person went out. We find this examples of this when one person sins and the whole Edah is, shall we say, blamed for it, like in the case of Achan. So it's possible that this story is really the second half of that story, meaning that this guy is the guy who went out to collect. And it's before Matan Torah. And so therefore, the particular system is not yet in place. So it could be that he got skila then. There are certain difficulties with that, but that's, again, not my main point. I just want to, as an aside. However, the fact that this fellow is mentioned and he's not identified raised some curiosity for Chazal. And we see it here first in the Sifri in Bamidbar in our parasha. V'imtzu'u ish b'koshesh etzim, source 2. First of all, what was he doing? B'koshesh is not itself a malacha. So what was he doing? So tolesh min hakarka. He was pulling stuff out of the ground. Now that's a little weird because what was he pulling out of the ground? Was he pulling wood out of the ground? Was he chopping down a tree? What was he doing? But they're proposing that he was tolesh min hakarka, that a malacha he was involved with was essentially a form of katsira, of harvesting. And I watch the interesting thing that they raise, which starts the whole discussion. It's a little humorous to us, because we know it's not the case. Maybe they found a guy whose name was Mikoshesh. Right? So now take a look at the story. Mr. Mekoshesh. Right? Talmud Lomar, Kribotom, Otsimotom, Mekoshesh Etzim. So we see now that Mekoshesh Etzim is a descriptor of the guy. And we see that from the next pasuk. So therefore, we know that Mekoshesh was his activity, not his name. Okay, again, once we know that, the proposal sounds kind of humorous. In any case, so that's what he was doing. And this is then what opens the door. Who was this guy? Now, what would be the simple answer to that question, who was this guy? The simple answer would be, who cares? Like, I don't need to know the name of everybody who did anything in history or anything did everybody who did anything in Tanakh. And they come up with an interesting suggestion, which is Miza Hayazah Slofchad. It was Slofchad, the famous father of Benot Slofchad, which, of course, who else could he be? Divrei Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva claims that the identity of the Mekoshesh is Slofchad. And what's his proof? Ne'mar kan Bamidbar, in the beginning of our parsha, Vayuvnei Yisrael Bamidbar. Ne'mar lalan midbar. What's that? Avinu meit Bamidbar. Benot Slofchad come forward to Moshe and say, our father died Bamidbar. Oh, that must be the guy about the story of the Midbar, which of course is strange because that's the only place they are, is in Midbar. Midbar Sinai, Midbar Tzin, Midbar Paran. I didn't go in order, but Midbarim, Midbarot. Ma Midbar, Ur Lalan Sofchad, Midbar Murkan Sofchad. So Gzera Shabbat. That's Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Yerun Batera has an interesting take. He says, Ata Atid Litain Etadin. Anybody who claims that the Mekoshesh was Slofchad, and by the way, or who claims anybody else is the Mekoshesh, meaning who identifies the Mekoshesh by any name, is going to pay for it. Why? If God kept his name quiet, and you're revealing him, right? So an interesting thing, the Mekoshesh is presented anonymously. Rabbi Akiva sees that as an invitation to identify who he is. Rabbi Yehuda ben Batera sees that as a direct divine block against trying to identify who he is. God decided not to tell us. Why are you getting involved? We're going to see a more explicated version of that in the Gemara in a couple minutes. So he's, but Rabbi Yehuda ben Batera doesn't stop there. If he stopped there and he said, Bikiva, if there's no name, there's no name. And that means God doesn't want us to know who it is. Finished. But then what does he do? He says, Ela mi'ayin haya mina ma'pilim haya. So I'll tell you how Slofchad died, which means half of the puzzle he's ready to solve, the other half he's not ready to solve. Slofchad died, and we don't know why. The Mekoshesh was killed. We know why. We don't know who it is. So Bikiva put one and one together and got two. The Mekoshesh Bamidbar is Slofchad Bamidbar. Okay. Yehuda ben Batera says, look, we know Slofchad, and Slofchad's name is known in Chumash, and God decided not to put it in there, so you're now violating God's will by exposing who he is. Maybe. Except that I think I know how Slofchad died, and it wasn't that. He was one of the Ma'pilim. Who are the Ma'pilim? The Ma'pilim are at the end of the narrative part of our Parsha, when Moshe tells them, you're all going to stay in the Midbar, and you're going to die in the Midbar, and your kids will be born, and they'll come into the land. Then there's a group of people who insist, no, we're going to take the land. They seem to want to do tshuva in a very excitable way, and they decide they're going to go to Har Arad, and they're going to come in and conquer the land, in spite of the fact that Hashem has given them the decree. And Moshe says, don't go, because Hashem's not with you, and you'll get creamed. And the word there is vayapilu lalotahar. They go up, they push themselves, and they go up to the mountain. Now, of course, this gave rise to a very different group in the 1930s and 40s, known as the Ma'pilim, which are the people who helped Jews get off of boats and get past the British blockade and get into Israel. And they, of course, are heroic. But these Ma'pilim were sinners, and they ended up dying. They did the wrong thing because Hashem said you need them to stay in the desert. So now, Slofchad is now half of the puzzle solved. Slofchad's context of death is placed. So the question is, why is it any better to identify Slofchad as one of the Ma'pilim than to identify Slofchad as the Mekoshesh? And I'll ask you a different question. Which is worse? If you have to be neighbors with one guy, you want to be neighbors with the Mekoshesh or one of the Mapilim? What do you think?
The latter.
Right. I would too. The Mekoshesh is an out-and-out Mechalel Shabbat for his own needs. The Mapilim are wrongly directed national heroes. They're national failures, but they're because they're wrongly directed, but they're trying to fight on behalf of Am Yisrael, conquer the land. Okay. So you could say that Rabbi Yehuda ben Pateira is saying, look, I'm going to take the softest known thing that I found in the Midbar, where it says people died, and I'll put Tzofchad there, because I like Tzofchad. It's a good guy. I'm not going to make him a Mekoshesh, but I will make him one of the Mapilim who are also anonymous. By the way, I could have made him one of the Korach guys, except that Benot Tzofchad say he wasn't that part of that group. I could have just said he died because he was part of the decree that anybody's going to die who's over 20. But instead, Bavono Mate seems to indicate that he had his own particular sin. So, okay, it was one of the Mapilim. We're going to see this get a little bit more explicated in the Sifri Zuta. The Sifri Bamidbar, by the way, is from the school of Rabbi Ishmael. The Sifri Zuta is from the school of Rabbi Akiva. It's the Midrash Halacha on Bamidbar. And Vayuvenei Yisrael Bamidbar, source 3, Amar Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov. Ne'amar kan Vayuvenei Yisrael Bamidbar, ne'amar la'alan avinu meit Bamidbar. Ma Midbar sh'ne'amar la'an Tzofchad, Bamidbar amur kan Tzofchad. So in other words, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov is adopting what Rabbi Akiva said. Amar lo Rabbi Shimon, if Charlem war mekoshesh hayat Tzofchad. So he opposes identifying Tzofchad as the mekoshesh for a different reason. Right? He says Tzofchad could not have died now. Why? Mipnei shaya mekoshesh b'shana rishona. He says the mekoshesh event happened in the first year, besrim ve'achad l'chodesh hasheni. And by the way, when's that? That's the Mun. This is before we got Torah. B'chiev sharshu b'not Tzofchad b'not Melachim na'olu k'sherot ha'ktana sheben ha'yta yoshevet 40 shana ad shelo niseit. The image of b'not Tzofchad is that they're attractive and that they're smart and that a fine catch. And can you imagine if Tzofchad died in the first year in the Midbar and the whole episode of b'not Tzofchad happened in year 40, you imagine that he's already had all five girls, because you have to have kids before you die. Doesn't work afterwards. And to say that they would wait around for that long before even being ready to get married, that means they're already in their 40s or older, doesn't make sense. Therefore, Tzofchad had to die closer to year 40 than year 1. Okay. Now, of course, Rabbi Shimon here is assuming that the Mekoshesh happened before Matan Torah and happened as soon as they left Egypt, right? And so therefore, they can't be Tzofchad. So notice, there's opposition in the Sifri to the fact that God deliberately kept him anonymous. There's opposition in Sifri Zuta on facts, saying it can't be Tzofchad because of information, right? So then he says, and he says, Tzofchad died in the wars that happened on the East Bank in the year 40. Okay. And now notice they make another comment. And it's a strange comment here in the Sifri Zuta. What's the point of that? Ish achad haya. It says Ish. Why would I think differently? Okay, good. Then the answer is that they're actually addressing something about the nature of anonymity in Tanakh, which is our main focus. But first, one more source about this Tzofchad connection, because you're going to see three different approaches to the problem. One approach you saw, which was God deliberately kept his identity secret. Therefore, you're violating God's will by exposing him. Sounds like I really know who he is, but hush, hush. But no, he's not really that. He's Mapilim. Then there's Rabbi Shimon who says, it can't be Tzofchad. I don't care if you tell anybody, but it can't be Tzofchad because the facts don't work. All right, and now number three. Tana Rabbanan, Mekoshesh zet Tzofchad, v'chir v'im Yisrael b'amidbar v'im Tzu'ish. Right, source 4 in Masechet Shabbat. Lalan omer avinu meit b'amidbar. Exactly like we saw in the Sifri. Midbar, ma'an Tzofchad avkan Tzofchad divrei Rabbi Akiva. This is Rabbi Akiva we saw right here. Same exact thing. But here's the difference. Amar l'avinu meit b'amidbar. Now, in the Sifri, Rabbi Yehuda ben Pateira said to him, God kept his name secret. You're exposing it. You're gonna be punished. But rather, he's one of the Mapilim. But now he says it all differently. Akiva ben kachu ben kachatati the tenadin. What does ben kachu ben kach mean? Whether you're right or wrong, you're going to pay. Meaning, you might be right that he's slavchad, and then you're going to be punished. You might be wrong that he's slavchad, and then you'll be punished. Why? Im kidvarecha, if you're right, and this part is like the Sifri. Hatarakisto ve'ata megaleoto. The Torah Dafka kept his name secret, kept his identity, withheld his identity, and you're exposing it. That's a sin. V'imlav, but if it's not mekutzofchad, then what happens? Ata motzila zelotot tzaddik. Now, there's no reason to say that tzofchad tzaddik. Tzaddik here means like the biblical tzaddik. He's an innocent guy. You're accusing an innocent guy and you're slandering his reputation by saying he's a mekoshesh. Ve'elaha gamar gzereshava. But hey, Rabbi Kiva had a gzereshava. Isn't that good enough? Meaning, what we're saying at this point is that if he's right that it's tzofchad, then not only is that correct that it is tzofchad, but the Torah hinted to it, and therefore he's not violating God's will because there's a gzera shava. And the gzera shava says that we're not going to tell you his name explicitly, but we're going to give you enough hints that you can figure it out. Midbar, midbar. So Rabbi Kiva's on safe ground. The answer is gzera shava lo gamar, that Rabbi Yehuda ben Tera just didn't have that same tradition of the gzera shava. There is a development in the later development of gzera shava, not at the beginning of it, which is quite early, that a gzera shava can only be utilized if you have a tradition to put those two words and connect them and create the association. So then, Rabbi Yehuda ben Tera, or the Braita says, who was he? Miviapilu have, which means we have a hybrid between the Sifri and the Sifri Zutra, right? We have purely from the Sifri, that there's an identification of Sofchad being from Vayapilu. But now, the wording in the Gemara is very strange, because the way that the Brit is dealt with. Because in the original Brit, in the Sifri, it's very straightforward. He says, God kept the identity of the Mekoshesh anonymous. You are claiming that it's Sofchad, so you're violating God's will. And besides that, a second point is, I could tell you a Sofchad died, it was something else. In the Gemara, though, it's a little bit different. He's saying, either way, whether you're right or wrong, meaning he's allowing for it to be right and allowing for it to be wrong, and either way, you're in trouble. And then at the end, he comes on and says, but by the way, it's from the Mapilim, which means, by the way, the earlier sentence doesn't make sense. Why would he say, if you're right or if you're wrong, either way, you're in trouble, when I know that you're wrong because I know that it was one of the Mapilim? So it seems to be kind of a reworking of the Braita that's going on here, which speaks to the issue of anonymity, which is when the Torah keeps somebody's identity silent, you should not impute who it is, because either you're right, in which case you're violating the will of the text, or the will of the author, capital A, or else you're wrong, in which case you're besmirching somebody. Now, of course, that doesn't hold in all cases of anonymity. That's when the anonymity is about somebody doing something wrong. So what I'd like to do now, and we'll try to come back to this at the end, is take a survey of anonymity in Tanakh. The Mekoshesh is anonymous. We know that. And one question we have left hanging over is that last comment of the Sifri Zuta, which is Isha Charaya, what the purpose of that is. We'll keep that in mind. But when else is anonymity utilized in Tanakh? So sometimes anonymity is utilized because the person is just not that important. An example of that is in this story, in source 5. Yosef is sent by his father to go find his brothers. And on the way, he comes to Shechem, where they're supposed to be, and they're not there. And he bumps into a man. And Yosef's wandering on the field, and the man says, what are you looking for? He says, I'm looking for my brothers. And the man says, they've gone to Dothan. With the Midrashim and Gavriel, etc., beautiful, but simple pshat in the text is this man is a foil. His job is to get Yosef from Shechem to Dothan so that he can meet his brothers and get thrown in the pit and become king of Egypt and save the world. All right, all of that. But the guy himself is an extra. You pay him a union scale, $100 a day, show up, stand there, wait till Yosef to show up, tell him where to go and go home. That's it. And therefore, his identity is insignificant. Who he is doesn't matter. There is yet another type of anonymity which shows up in Tanakh. And how do I test that? Well, let me ask you. The Ish in source 5, do I ever find out who he is in the text? I never hear who he is. I never at some point say, Beha Ish, Hasher, Ma Yosef, oh, Gabriel Malach. I never hear that. But what happens if I have a story with anonymous characters and at a later point in the text, I find out who they are? I can't say they're insignificant because the text took out time to tell me who they are. So what would be the reason for it? So if you take a look at the story, which is source 6, these first 10 psukim of the second chapter of Shemot, it is the story of the birth and saving of Moshe and ultimately his adoption as the adopted son of the princess. Okay? And this story is riddled with anonymity and deliberate anonymity. There are 5 characters in this story and then a bunch of extras, but all the characters are anonymous. There's a man from the house of Levi and he takes a daughter of Levi. No names. The woman becomes pregnant and she has a son. What's the son's name? We'll never find out. She puts the boy into the basket, and now his sister, we never heard about his son. He's got a sister. What's her name? We don't know. And she watches to see what's going to happen. And now we've got a princess who also has no name. She's Bat Paro, but no name. And she goes, and she's got her extras. The other girls are there. So far we have 5 characters, father, mother, baby, sister, princess, right? And then what happens? She sees the boy, and the sister says to Bat Paro, should I go call you a nursemaid from the Hebrews? By the way, why would the Hebrews be good candidates for nursemaids? Because they're all lactating because their kids were killed. And babies and their kids were killed. And Bat Paro says, go. And the young girl, who's the young girl? The sister. Who's the sister? I don't know. She goes and calls the mother. Who's the mother? I don't know. And Bat Paro says to her, take this boy. What's the kid's name? I don't know. Now, this kid's got to have a name. They didn't just call him for 3 months, hey, you, basket case. What do they call him? They had a name. And the woman takes the boy, and then the boy grows up, which means he's now a few years old, growing up in his own house, by the way, with mom, dad, sister, who all have no names. And the mother brings her to Bat Paro, and she adopts him as a son, and she calls him Moshe, which, of course, is Egyptian for child. And the drush of Mina Mai Mishitiyo was added in later. Okay. Totally anonymous. Why is this so anonymous? It's like deliberately in your face anonymous. So there is a note about Parshanut, which I think is itself significant, is Parshanut, interpretive strategies of Tanakh, are not from Sinai. They're not from Sinai. They are things that develop over the millennia in different milieu that are impacted by different cultural interactions. So, for instance, when the Ibn Ezra puts such an emphasis in his Parshanut on grammar, that's something that we actually got from the Muslims, the emphasis on grammar, and that has to do with their study of the Quran, etc. And it was recognized as a valuable tool and a critical thing to the point where the Ibn Ezra was willing to say, somebody who does not understand grammar doesn't know Chumash at all. They don't understand it. And this is true in every generation, that new information that comes either internally or externally and is recognized as a valid piece of the way to look at things is then utilized. It's not only true discipline-wise, it's also true experientially, that when the world has experienced things, when a community has experienced things, it may be sometimes traumatic what they've experienced, but it does open their eyes to new ways of looking at the text. How many times have we heard, and I don't think it's accurate at all, but how many times have we heard people in their homiletic excesses talking about Shibud Mitzrayim and using the Shoah as a model? I mean, I've heard it a number of times. I try not to walk out, but now notice that that's not a model that anybody could have used before 1950 when we understood what had gone on, and certainly not before the 20th century. Now, in the same vein, though, I'd like to point out that Nechama Leibovich, who was like the greatest Tanakh teacher as a teacher of the 20th century, perhaps, and had thousands upon thousands of students, had an observation about this Parsha, which is really insightful, but I don't think she could have had it 100 years earlier. She said, the last pasuk in the previous parak says that Paro then made a decree, which was every baby boy gets thrown in the river. And the very next pasuk is Vayelachish. So she said, you would think that the result of that decree would be that people would stop having kids. People would separate and they would stop having kids and they would basically ZPG. And she said, that's not the case. People continued in spite of the decree. And this, of course, brings to mind the ghettos and even in some cases the camps where people continue to have marriages and even try to have babies. And there were babies born in the camps. And I believe that Nechama, you had that awareness and then drove that into here. And that the anonymity is really a way of saying it's universal, meaning another guy went, and this is happening all over the place. Everybody's continuing to have kids. It's a nice piece. I don't think it's pshat. I think a pshat in this parsha is that this story has to have a lightning, a laser beam shining on this little baby. And don't get distracted by other stuff. Don't get distracted by Amram and Yocheved and Miriam and whatever Batya, Bitya, or whatever her name might be. Or this kid, Tuvia, whatever his name is. Focus on the baby. Because the story of this baby is really foreshadowing Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Watch it. This is the harbinger of the Geula, and this will be the trailblazer. You know what? Later on, we'll tell you the name. So in a few prakim, we hear it's Amram and Yocheved, and he's got a brother Aaron, he's got a sister Miriam. We got all that information. We never find out his name, but we got all the information. So sometimes anonymity is there to allow you to focus on the story and not get distracted by the names. Sometimes anonymity is there because people do something wrong and their reputation is protected. And so the people who kept mon over and it spoiled, the people who went out to collect mon, I want to bring something that was close to our situation. Now, on the other hand, it could be that there were a lot of people doing it. And by two Anashim, maybe a lot of people did it. And so it's also going to stay anonymous because you're not going to list all the names. There is, in Megillat Rut, there are two functions of names which are interested in. And we're going to end with that and bring it back to our original point. In Megillat Rut, all the central characters are presented with a little bit of a hiccup. Meaning, instead of saying "Vayi b'meish v'ra shoftim v'arvar," it's "Vayelech Eli Melech," pasuk source 9. "Mibet Lachem Yehuda hu unami ishto." Instead, a man from Bet Lachem and he goes to Moab. He and his wife and his two sons. And then we're told the man's name is Eli Melech. And it seems to be a little bit extra. We find out the same thing in Perek Bet when we're introduced to Boaz. Instead of being introduced to Boaz, we're talking Naomi has a family friend. And he's a very wealthy man, and he's from the family of Elimelech, and his name is Boaz. Now, there's a tension there, because you know at the beginning of the story, you want to know who this guy is, and his wife is, and the two kids are who leave. And here, you want to find out who's Naomi's friend, who we hope is going to help her and save her. She's broke, right? So the tension helps build up a suspense, which Tanakh uses in order to tell you, pay attention to the names. The names are meaningful. The names speak to the story. Eli Melech is a wonderful name. And at the end of this entire story of Megillat Rut, he's going to be the one whose name is redeemed. His wife is amazing. Noam and Amin, Naomi, can't do better. On the other hand, their sons are Machlon and Chilion, which literally mean disease and destruction. Great names, probably not their real names, but anyhow, how we play it, that's what plays out with them. They both die childless. Boaz. Right? No. Nomi's got a family friend, and he's very wealthy, and his name is Boaz. So you got to pay attention to the word. Boaz means strength is in him. As a matter of fact, in Greek, it's pronounced Boaz, like strength is in him. And indeed, he demonstrates unbelievable strength in the next chapter when Ruth comes to him and literally throws herself at his feet, and he tells her to stay down by the feet. Right? And nobody else is around, and yet he behaves that way. So the name does serve as a meaningful, meaning the nature of the name is meaningful as to who the character is. Adobe asks whether or not the same thing is true at the beginning of Shmuel, and also is the same true at the beginning of, in Perek Tet and Shmuel when Shaul is introduced, or Kish is introduced. I think so also. It's like, this is the one you're waiting for, anticipation. Good point. And the names there may be also meaningful. You think of Shaul and how it really is the name that Shmuel should have gotten. And so we have this phenomenon that that happens elsewhere, but Ruth is like an easy place to look. Plus, we just read Ruth a couple weeks ago. But there's one more phenomenon, and I kept it type six, and I didn't put it, which is anonymity, which is deliberate, pointed, punitive anonymity. All the anonymity we've spoken about is either in order to do something with the story itself, or in order to protect the person, or in order to indicate that this behavior is universal behavior. There is one example we have of punitive anonymity. When Boaz sat down by the gate and his relative walked out, he did not say to him, Sura shva po ploni almoni. Come sit here, ploni almoni. He said to him, Sura shva po chayim yanko. He called him by his name. Moshe, Zitzavek. But the text takes his name out, and the text calls him John Doe. The text redacts him, if you will. And why is that? Because the entire enterprise that's taking place here, that Boaz uses in order to be able to marry Ruth, and in order to be able to redeem the field, is for one purpose, Lahakim Shem Hamet al Nachlato, to keep alive, to revive the and maintain the name of the dead man, meaning Elimelech, on his property by buying the property and then having kids who are somehow related to Elimelech, that's its own legal fiction, on that property. It's Elimelech's name that he's saving. What did Ploni Almoni refuse to do? Refused to do that full number. He refused to marry Ruth. And as a result of that, he was, since he would not do what he needed to do to save the name of his relative, therefore his name is wiped out. So anonymity, in that one example, is actually a punitive act. When we come back to it, we then take a look at the Mekoshesh. Why is the Mekoshesh anonymous? The simple explanation is that we want to protect his reputation. Bad enough the guy was the first Mechal Shabbos in history, and bad enough that the guy got skila. We also have to publicize it and shame his family. We don't need to do that. But notice, it's critical. It says, Vayimtzu ish isha charaya. Why is that important? Well, first of all, because, as I said, sometimes anonymity speaks to unanimity, meaning anonymity may be a reflection of the fact that a lot of people are doing this. And so not mentioning a name because everybody's doing this. The Midrash says, no, Ish Mekoshesh is one guy. That's it. There's one guy. But there's another piece to the puzzle. What would be the value of publicizing his name if, you know, I did a terrible thing and he was killed? After all, Achan, not only do we get his name, we get his yichus, his Beit Av, his Shevet, and everything else, and he's killed. What's in between Achan and this guy? So the answer seems to be straightforward. Achan behaved in a way, but Achan lives with other people. And other people see their father, their brother, their cousin, taking stuff, not following the commands, not operating the proper way. That is a cancer that can spread very quickly. You have to identify who it is and make it very clear. And everybody in the family has to know, we're all keeping an eye on you. And if we see Achan type behavior, you're in trouble. What's the point of this midrash? Isha charaya, meaning this was one lone guy who went out to collect. Independent of and out of the context of family, friends, tribe, whatever it is. He's some lone soul who goes out to collect. And therefore, we have no value whatsoever in publicizing his name. It's not unanimity. It's not universality. There's nothing about his name that's important. The guy himself is not an important character. And we do not have a concern that his behavior is going to impact on others because Isha Charaya. He worked on his own. And therefore, there's no value whatsoever to publicizing it. And then we'll fall back on the anonymity, which is used to protect reputation. This is why Rabbi Yehuda ben Matera gets so angry at Rabbi Kiva. He says to Rabbi Kiva, look at this. The Torah went out of its way to just say Ish and leave it at Ish and not tell us his name. There's a good reason for that. The Torah understood that there's no value in this case to identifying who he is. He's not part of a group. He's not influencing others. Let it lie. But Sofchad was part of the Mapilim. Why is that important? Because the Mapilim were a group. And the Mapilim's attitude, we'll take things in our own hands, is a dangerous attitude. And there was a value to identifying who it was. So hopefully this clarifies some broader things about anonymity, but also some local things about the Mekoshesh in this particular story.